Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends Bear Crickets. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left for today's special episode of TCCP is none other than Hampshire and former Middlesex middle order batter, Nick Gubbins. So Nick, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining me here on the podcast today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on for chat about all things County Cricket. I have to ask, mate, how's your day been so far?
Yeah, it's been good, thank you. We've got a week off this week, Hampshire. So I've gone to the Isle of Wight for a few days and I've spent the morning swimming in the sea. So slightly different from facing the new ball, but it's quite an enjoyable morning.
You are kidding. The fact that you said Isle of Wight, first and foremost, absolutely beautiful part of the country. And then you mentioned the sea. Now, for me as a Midlander, we unfortunately don't have access to a sea here in Shakespeare's County, but sounds like quite the morning, Nick. I'm guessing you're enjoying your week off at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. The week off basically looks like windsurfing in a wetsuit at this time of year, that's for sure. And just trying to get away from anything but cricket, really. So enjoying the week off, and I managed to get tickets for the FA Cup final on Saturday yesterday. So I'm heading up to London at the end of the week and taking my brother and my best mate, who are sadly Liverpool fans, but I'm a big Chelsea fan. So yeah, it's looking like quite the week off at the moment.
I was about to say, lucky for some, eh? You got the week off cricket, and then you got the FA Cup final to look forward to. That is absolutely class, to be honest, Nick. And before we get into the main content of the podcast, which will surround your cricketing journey to date, I do just have to ask, is the county season beginning to take its toll a little bit? We have heard this on the podcast in terms of the county grind. Yes, more so for bowlers as opposed to the batters, but has it been quite physically demanding in these past few weeks?
I guess it depends on how your side's doing, really. You always feel a bit more tired or fatigued if you're coming off some losses and you've spent a lot of time in the field. But fortunately for me, I'm part of a pretty strong Hampshire bowling attack, I'm on the same side as them, so we don't tend to spend that much time in the field when you've got Abbas, Abbott and Barker bowling. So we've had a couple of days in the field at the Oval, and there were some long days, and yeah, I would say we were fatigued after that week. But yeah, otherwise we've been dominating games, and cricket's highly enjoyable when you do so.
It most certainly is. It's always better when you've got that winning feeling, isn't it, in any sport, but even more so in a game as challenging as the game of cricket. And it's been an excellent start to the summer. It really has for Hampshire County Cricket Club, obviously going for that first county championship title since 1973. It's almost been 50 years since the Southern County last lifted that trophy. Nick, I know this is a very cliche question. Do you think you can do it this year? Is 2022 the year?
I think, yeah, absolutely. We came very close last year, obviously. We came within a ball, which, you know, it was very tough to take, and we felt like we should have won it. So that was very frustrating. But again, over the winter, we've recruited really well. Ben Brown is obviously an outstanding signing and offers obviously his amount of runs, but his experience and just general kind of attitude to winning in and around the squad, which is really exciting. And then we've retained the likes of Merbass and players like that. So it's really exciting time for the county. And I guess you can't really win the county championship in April and May, but you can certainly put yourselves out of it. And I guess all we've done so far is we're competing, we're up there, and that's all we can do up until September. And then if the cards fall right in September, then we want to make sure that we're one of three or four counties who can win it.
Absolutely. Well, it has been quite the start to the summer. As I said, currently second in Division 1 on 81 points, just 8 points behind Surrey. It's got the makings of a very, very intriguing title race, as we'll touch upon later on in today's podcast. But Nick, before we jump the gun a little bit too much, of course, when we talk about Hampshire, we talk about the 2022 season and the years beyond that, really. I just wanted to transport all the way back to the origins of your cricketing journey, if I may. So in terms of where the Nick Gubbins cricketing tale actually started, so what were your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching this sensational game?
First, first set of memories, because I grew up in Singapore for the first 6 or 7 years of my life, from about two to eight or around then. So dad worked in Singapore, so we lived out there, and he played for Singapore Cricket Club. So my earliest memories would have been on the boundary with my brother, just playing with a bat and ball. And he'd come off the field and we'd run onto the field and greet him. So I guess those were the earliest memories. And then from there, a lot of garden cricket with my brother, who's 4 years older than me. I like to think he's had a massive role in my career, because I was always punching above my weight by playing with him, I guess, as a younger brother. And then, just moving into school cricket. I was fortunate enough to play some good school cricket when I was younger. And then my first cricket club was Stirling's Cricket Club in Sussex. So I've spent many a summer there up until I joined the Middlesex Academy.
Well, I'll tell you what, Nick, it's been quite the journey, hasn't it, since those formative days. And you mentioned Singapore. What a lovely place to spend part of your childhood. And I have to ask, because it is quite an apt question, actually, given the fact that Tim David will be in county cricket this year for the Lancashire Lightning. Have you ever been tempted to be called up to the national side? Are you eligible?
Yeah, it's never really crossed my mind to apply, but I'm not even sure how you do it. I mean, I wasn't born there, and I certainly don't have any Singapore blood in me. So I think I'm about as Singaporean as Tim Murtagh is Irish. So, take of that what you will.
A little bit gutted, to be honest there, Nick. I was thinking of that middle order duo of Nick Gubbins and Tim David batting together. Who knows? We might get it in county cricket one day. Janak Prakash as well, in the all-rounder position.
I don't know who the fans would rather watch. I might send a few to sleep and Tim might wake them up.
Fantastic. He is a great player, isn't he, Tim David? Cannot wait to see him in county cricket. Been having an excellent IPL for the Mumbai Indians. But I did just deviate off topic there. I do apologise, Nick. I just had to ask the question, to be honest. But getting back on track, aside from your dad and your brother, who I'm guessing has a massive influence on your cricketing journey, was there anybody in the professional game, either in the domestic circuit or indeed international cricket, that you looked at in those early days and thought, you know what, I'm going to emulate my game off of them, per se?
I wouldn't say emulate my game, but I certainly tried to copy Marcus Trescothick. I remember buying a GM Maxi because he used a GM Maxi. And that was certainly a real starstruck moment. The first time I played for Middlesex, it was my second game against Somerset. And I remember kind of playing against Trez, and have obviously played a lot against him since and met with him since. But yeah, I remember that first was just like, wow, yeah, he was one of my earliest heroes, Marcus Trescothick, along with probably Andrew Strauss, because of the Radley College connection. And he came into Radley, did a few sessions, and he was obviously England captain at the time. So that was pretty inspiring when I was starting to think quite strongly about cricket at 15, 14, 15, 16 or so. And then kind of lastly, the 05 Ashes with Kevin Peterson, and just the way that he took the Australians on and the way he batted, he was definitely a cricketing hero after what he did for England in those years.
Well, Nick, you've mentioned those wonderful words that we like to hear on the podcast, 05 Ashes, something which crops up time and time and time again. Obviously, that series has a huge impact on cricket in this country. It was an iconic series with so many incredible names on display. This is going to be a tough question, but we always ask it here on the podcast. If you could go back and relive just one day from that immortal series, which day would you go back to? And why?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the obvious answer would be the KP's 158 or that last morning at Edgbaston. But I think that first morning at Lord's was pretty special, that first day. Kind of the excitement of Lord's, the anticipation and rolling the Aussies out for 150 and then watching Glenn McGrath go about his work in awe, I think was pretty special as well. So I think that first day was pretty special. Probably not your most obvious answer either.
It isn't. I can't say that we've had that before on the podcast, actually, because obviously England went on to to lose the game first and foremost. But Glenn McGrath taking his 500th wicket, which was, funnily enough, Marcus Truscothick in that exact same test match. So an interesting choice. Is that because of the Middlesex connection? You know, the home ground is Lord's, home of cricket.
Lord's obviously such a special place. And just, I just remember personally just the anticipation of that first day. Just the excitement levels were just through the roof watching England tear in Harmer's and hit Ponting and Langer's forearm, Bruce forearm. It was, yeah, just all very vivid. And I can still remember that now. And then just watching, and even when I play at Lord's, just picturing Glenn McGrath strolling from that pavilion end and just nip it down the slope. Quite special, I think.
Absolutely. And we always use this as a follow-up question, to be honest, when we do talk about the 2005 Ashes. Nick Gubbins, do you have the box set? Yes or no?
Yes.
There we go. Again, that's just a shared thing, to be honest, a collectible item in county cricket. It seems that everybody has it. And again, for those who don't have it, try and find it. eBay, Amazon, whatever. Honestly, it's worth it. It's absolutely fantastic. That got me through lockdown, to be honest. But a great series, so many incredible moments. You mentioned Edgbaston as well. The tightest test in Ashes history. Great last day to an excellent, excellent game of cricket. And then, of course, the Oval, which was just iconic, wasn't it? The umpires lifting the bells off at the end, the moment of realisation that England have finally won an Ashes series for the first time in what felt like forever. So always nice to reminisce on that series. Unfortunately, 2021 to 2022 wasn't quite as special for us as England fans, as we're all well aware of, 4-0 at the hands of the Australians. But fingers crossed that in the future, we do have another chance to have a series like that, because it wasn't just remarkable for the on-field stuff. It's also the off-field fanfare, wasn't it, Nick? Would you say that cricket almost became more mainstream as a result of that series?
Absolutely. And obviously you had it on regular television as well, which I guess would help viewing figures and accessibility to the game. Obviously now being predominantly on Sky, accessibility to the game is less, isn't it, I guess? And I mean, all sorts has been said about that. But yeah, I mean, I think it was just the great players, the great Australian side. We obviously built them up massively, as a side because they beat us so much. But yeah, it's interesting. We have this debate now. I mean, now in the change room at times. I mean, what bowling attack was better, the 05 Australian bowling attack then or the Australian bowling attack now? And there are some mixed views because they're not too far off each other.
Well, go on, because you brought up the topic. Before we move on, we have to answer that question. Which one do you think is better?
I think seamers-wise, now, I think with Pat Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark, I think obviously Glenn McGrath was amazing. They had Brett Lee, who was superb. Jason Gillespie was the third seamer. But I think now, just as an all-round attack, the seamers probably now. And then, but I think what wins it is the Warn factor. Nathan Lyon is obviously a phenomenal, probably one of the best, or he is probably one of the best orthodox finger spinners ever. But the Shane Warne factor, I think, probably just tips it to that 05 bowling attack.
It's an interesting topic of debate, isn't it, to be honest? Because there's a lot which you could delve into. We're not going to here on the podcast, because otherwise it'll be a 10-hour Ashes special, Nick. I know you've got the Isle of Wight to go and enjoy, but honestly, what a pair of bowling attacks. The Aussies always seem to have strong bowlers. I mean, even thinking back to Lillian Thompson, to be honest, back in the 80s, but that is a really tough question. I would agree in terms of the same bowlers, but then, yeah, Shane Warne, 708 test wickets, obviously sorely missed by all of us here in the cricket community. That's a really tough question. Again, that might be something we'll have to ask on Twitter, Nick. You've got the creative juices flowing for us here at the County Cricket Podcast today. It's a great question. It's a very, very good question indeed. But going back onto your cricketing journey then, from those early days in Singapore, you mentioned Radley College as well. Let's talk about your path into the first class game, because first and foremost, you played for Leeds and Bradford MCCU. So how would you describe your experiences with the university scheme, and just how integral was that scheme in terms of furthering your journey as a professional cricketer?
Yeah, so the MCCU scheme for me was massive because at 18, it meant that I didn't have to choose between cricket and education or having a good time either. But yeah, it just seemed, you know, I was obviously very fortunate enough to go to a good school, which Dad worked very hard to send me to. So to then throw that all away and say, and just try and chase cricket would have been quite, you know, I think tricky for me. So, you know, in my head, it was always kind of get a degree alongside, and the MCCU scheme allowed me to train like a professional at times, enjoy myself, have a good time, and also get a degree. So it was, yeah, it was a, some of the funnest 3 years of my life so far. And it's one of the fondest memories I have from that scheme is beating Leicestershire at Grace Road in a first class game. You know, as a bunch of students, we're led by Lewis Rees then, who scored one of the most amazing hundreds in that game. It was as good as it's been in that game. So that was pretty special.
It's funny you mentioned there the factor of enjoyment alongside it as well. That is a common theme, to be honest. When we do talk with people who've come through the scheme, Lewis Rees being one of them, funny enough, here on the podcast, Chris Benjamin went to Durham. He went through their scheme. And then we've had a number of ones from Loughborough, had the likes of James Bracey, Michael Burgess, Sam Cook, to name but a few. It's a great, great initiative, isn't it? It's the fact that, as you said, you can have that education. So you've got the fallback option if necessary. But it's also like a taster, isn't it, into the world of professional cricket. And you mentioned that game against Leicestershire. Would you say that was your favourite moments from your time in the MCCU?
Yeah, definitely. A moment I do remember. There were some tough times as well. We seemed to, obviously, being at Leeds, Bradford, we used to play the Yorkshire. There's a very, very strong Yorkshire team. Not that they're never not strong, but that side then was particularly strong with Bairstow, Plunkett, Root. I mean, all of them, Sidebottom, Bresnan, to name but a few. But yeah, I remember my first class career was quite tricky at the start because I used to just play them 3 years on the bounce at Headingley in March. So it took a while for my first class batting stats to get going. But yeah, that was a tough introduction to first class cricket, but also kind of showed me that that's it really. That's the level you need to get to.
It most certainly is. And it's funny you mentioned that. You've gone from batting at Headingley, which is a seam-friendly track, let's be honest, in particular in March, and then the county club you've went on to play for in the years that followed was Middlesex at Lords. Again, not exactly the friendliest wickets for batsmen, shall we say. And in terms of those earliest memories of Middlesex, what are your first kind of interactions with the Saxes as a club? When did your journey in the professional game with Middlesex really begin in the first place?
So I joined Middlesex when I was 14 because Andy Wagner, my school coach, who was a massive part of my cricketing journey, we used to wake up early and have bowling machine sessions before school. And he still comes and watches now. And he's just finishing up, I think, in the next few years at Radley. So he's an age group coach at Middlesex and got me into the under 14 stuff, which I then progressed through onto the academy, worked closely with the academy on obviously Wags up until I was 18. And then when I was 18, I was offered a summer contract, and Angus Fraser was very supportive of me going to university and getting a degree. There was never any chat of, you know, not doing that. They were always hugely supportive, and I'm very thankful for that.
Well, that's good to hear, to be honest, Nick. And we do hear that quite often when it comes to Middlesex, a very supportive club, and they have got that fantastic network, haven't they, in terms of bringing up academy players, as we're seeing in 2022, with the likes of Joe Cracknell, Josh DeCares, you've got the likes of Tilanwalala Wheat coming through as well, and Luke Holman. It's a very, very good academy system that they've got down in North London. And from those early years with the Saxes then, let's talk about your first team debut. Because that must have been an incredibly proud moment, having come through that system at 14 and then making it out onto that field, representing your boyhood club for the first time. What can you remember from that day, and just how special was it in terms of your wider cricketing journey?
Yeah, it was obviously an incredibly proud moment. Needless to say, my one memory was thinking that no matter what happens in my cricketing career now, no one can ever take this away from me. You know, I'm a Middlesex player. So that was one overriding emotion. The other was just really proud kind of day for my parents who had given up so much to drive me to age group cricket and all of these, you know, camps and stuff that you trudge through as a county boy in the summer. So yeah, just a really satisfying feeling to give them some pride back, really, I guess. And yeah, I very nearly run out Chris Rogers. I opened up with Chris Rogers, which was quite cool. I nearly run him out to get off the mark, basically. If it was a direct hit, it would have been out. So yeah, there were a few nerves flying through, but I managed to get, I was dropped on 6 in the gully and then managed to go on and get a debut 50. So it was highly rewarding. Yeah. So very fortunate as well. You need a bit of luck in this game.
You do indeed, in particular at the top of the order, because as is just, you know, nature of the cricketing beast, you are going to fail a lot more times than you succeed. In particular, when you're opening the batting, you do need the rub of the green, quite literally, when you are out in the middle sometimes. That would have been quite the start to your first-class career with Middlesex, though, running out Chris Rogers. You're very lucky not to have have ran him out, to be honest. And then being dropped on 6. Can I just say, Nick, as well, great recall, really good recall of your debut, I'm guessing, well, from that passage, incredibly special then, and something which has quite clearly stuck with you throughout all of these years. And usually this is where we ask, was that the proudest moment of your time with the club? But I have a feeling that one of the years might just top that. Would I be correct in thinking that 2016 would be that year?
Yes, no, I think for everyone at the club, we made some history that year for the club, and it was an extremely special, I guess, last few months of the season. Because as ever, we put ourselves in a position and things end up falling right for us in the last few weeks. And I think that's the overriding theme of that season. We didn't start the season thinking, oh, well, this year's going to be our year, this year we're going to win it. We just wanted to play good cricket, and we put ourselves in and around there at the end of the season for things to go our way.
Well, you most certainly did, and we can't talk about 2016 without mentioning that final game of the season, can we? Yorkshire at Lords, and in particular the final day, the final moments of the season at that point. Nick, before we get on to Toby Rowland-Jones and the hat-trick and the emotions surrounding that extraordinary moment, one which lives in my memory to this day, I'm not even a Middlesex fan. That's how special it was for county cricket as a whole, let alone the club. Before a ball was bowled in that game, did you believe that by the end of it, you'd be lifting the county championship trophy?
I believe it was possible. I didn't believe that going into the final day, that's for sure. Because I think we led by 30 or something going into that final day. We led it by 30, and me and Mallow were batting 2 down. So it was like, well, how are we going to force a result at the moment? So I think Somerset were probably just waking up from their hangovers, having won the day before, and they were ready to helicopter the trophy down that way for and lift it in front of their fans. So yeah, certainly before that last day, it was a feeling of, don't really know where this is going, to be honest.
That's interesting to hear, because let's talk about the fourth day then, because this is where everything, you know, came down to it, to be honest, the final day of the season. And that stand with Dawid Malan first and foremost. So you scored 93 from 200 balls, 9 fours, and a cheeky 6 in there as well, in a 198 run third wicket stand. In terms of when you were out in the middle, did something feel different on that day, or was it just, you know, another day at the office for Nick Gubbins?
I was pretty gutted because I got out just before the underarms came out, so that would have been a few freebie runs. That was a bit gutting because obviously my good friend Eskenazi got those. No, joking aside, I mean, yeah, it was a bit of a whirlwind season. And yeah, I guess things at the time are probably a bit of a blur looking back, and it was just, I was very much stuck in my processes. And because you're part of of a side that's competing for a trophy, you don't really think about yourself. It's all about what the team needs, and it's all about, you know, how are we going to win this trophy. And we had some very good leaders around us, and, you know, we obviously had a really good experience changer. I mean, Compo, James Franklin was our captain, standing in for Voges, who wasn't there. But I just remember Franklin just kept saying to us, like, take the game deep, just keep batting. And I was thinking, well, do I need to do anything this morning? Do I need to put my foot down? And I remember I tried a shot and a message came out from the dressing room saying, just keep batting. It's all fine. Things will be good.
And things certainly turned out to be good, didn't they? By the end of the game, we have to talk about the moment. Toby Rowland-Jones will go down in history for this, won't he? It's one of the most incredible finishes to a county championship ever. Dismissing Azim Rafiq, Andy Hoss and Ryan Sidebottom with a hat-trick to bring Middlesex their first county championship trophy since 1993. Nick, if you can go about describing it for, you know, the fans out there, what was that moment like? Did it really set in, or was it just pure ecstasy at that moment? What was that particular moment like?
I mean, from my point of view, I was at deep point. So I just saw the ball delivered, obviously, from Toby. You're pretty nervous as well because, you know, there was a decent crowd in. You know, I think that 10,000, with 10 to 15,000 in by that stage. So it was good. It was a good atmosphere, first and foremost. And there was only four or five overs to go. And you were nervous because you just wanted to get it done. But you were like, well, what happens if it doesn't? And I just remember seeing those stumps go and just running over to the boys, just, yeah, in a state of ecstasy, as you guess. And yeah, just, yeah, very, I guess that's what a lot of people feel in some great sporting moments, I guess, that, yeah, feeling of ecstasy.
Well, you can't really put it into words, can you, to be honest? When you think of all the sacrifices, not just in the season, but in your life up until that point, all of it has led to this moment. And you think of Middlesex as a club. That was just their 11th county championship trophy in, up until that point, their 126-year history. It's absolutely staggering to have been a part of one of those starting 11s, which went on to lift the trophy, the one that everybody wants. It's our version of the Premier League, but arguably with a lot more history. It's been going since 1890, as opposed to the 1990s. How long did it take to settle in, if it did at all, Nick? You know, after that final day, obviously you've got the moment itself and the delirium, the ecstasy of Toby Rowland-Jones' hat-trick. You've got the celebrations after. But how long did it take to really settle in, just the magnitude of what you guys had achieved on that day at all?
Yeah, you obviously had that day, had the parties the days after. And I think when you achieve kind of anything in the world, whether it's, you know, winning the World Cup or winning the Premier League or the Champions League, you always hear managers or players talk about afterwards, you know, what now? And it almost, from that high, you do have a bit of a come down, and it's like, is this it almost? Is this what we've been, now that we've achieved all that we're looking for? Is this it? So I do remember kind of sitting down with Angus Fraser, you know, a month later, and he was just like, yeah, I mean, we've achieved what now, you know, we've achieved what we've set out to do. So you do have to recalibrate. And yeah, it was obviously a tough year later for the club. And whether people say that's because we didn't recalibrate, who knows? I think it's part of sport. If you're going to have the highs, you've got to, you know, take the lows as well. So I don't think there's any particular reason why that season happened, but we didn't get on the same roll that we did the season before, and certain things went against us with the bone arrow gate and various points here and there. It didn't materialise.
No, it certainly didn't. Again, an incredibly rough time for the club after the elation and jubilation of 2016, everything came crashing down in the very next season, which must have been incredibly tough to take. And Nick, I know, again, this is a bit of a common question, but would you say that was the toughest moment during your time with the Saxes? Having gone from champions of England, all of a sudden the club's relegated, you're in Division 2, you've gone from the champions to not even having a chance to lift that trophy in 2018. Was that the toughest moment for you in a Middlesex shirt, or was something else have topped that?
Those couple of years were tough. That moment of relegation was extremely tough, realizing that this has actually happened. And I think the next year as well, the 2018, I think the fact that we didn't get back up hurt a lot as well, because suddenly, you know, Division 2 is a real scrap, and, you know, the club are scrapping really well at the moment. And at this moment in time, they're doing really nicely, which is great to see. But yeah, it's a real scrap to get up, and that realization that, geez, we're not just going to get back up here. We you know, what's happening? And, you know, every year you're thinking, can we get back up? And yeah, it's not easy. But yeah, those couple of years were tough to take. But I still, to this day, would rather have done what we did and won it and been relegated than Somerset and not won it at all. And
fair enough. I'm not sure the Somerset fans tuning into today's podcast will necessarily agree, to be honest, with the rubbing in of the salt.
Would you rather finish second? I mean, they obviously finished second that year or and the year after. But yeah, I would have rather won it and been relegated, I think.
Fair enough. I mean, in fairness, you do have the trophy to show for it, and that's something which can never, ever be taken away from the club or indeed that group of lads. It was a remarkable achievement, but it has been a shame, hasn't it, to be honest, in recent years, having gone from that extraordinary season in 2016, the club just have not, for some reason or another, been able to get back to Division 1. So fingers crossed for Middlesex fans out there. That can, of course, change maybe in 2022. Who knows? If the club get promoted, that'd be absolutely fantastic. And Nick, in terms of your time at Middlesex then, just one final question, really, quite a profound one, was when did you start thinking of leaving the club, really? Because obviously now you're at Hampshire, you've been at Hampshire for a couple of seasons now, but when did the moments of almost realization that you wanted a change come about?
Well, I entered my last year of my contract at the end of at the start of last season, that would be the 21 season, and there was no guarantee of Division One cricket. We didn't really know where the divisions were going, whether we were going to continue with the Bob Willis Trophy. And at I would have been 27 then. It was a big point in my career, because almost if I sign a big contract extension, that probably keeps me there forever. Then I'll be 30 and what have you. Not that that's old, but I think it was just it felt like a big step of a big moment in my career. And because I wasn't offered a multi-year deal, I guess I was offered a year extension. I stayed in my final year and then spoke to counties when I was allowed to in July, and was really impressed by what I saw at Hampshire. Saw the squad they were building and had built already, and felt that it was time for a change and a freshen up.
Was that a rather tough decision though? Because you had only played your cricket for Middlesex up until that point for essentially seven seasons. You'd made 152 appearances for the club as well across formats. I can completely understand that, the new pastures almost, and that opportunity for Division One cricket. Did that outweigh the difficulty?
Yeah, it was extremely tough, and the emotions were high. I remember telling Gus, Angus Fraser and Stu Law, myself, and I burst into tears in the pavilion. I remember driving out of the Lord's Gates for the last time, and I was just in absolute tears in my car. And not afraid to admit that, because, you know, Middlesex were a massive part of my life, and I owe them, you know, a huge amount of gratitude for the support and chances they gave me as a youngster. But from a purely selfish point of view, you know, once I did drive out of those gates and say goodbye, I've stayed in touch with a lot of guys there. I've got a lot of friends there. But it was then when I drove down the M3 and met the rest of the squad at Hampshire, they made me feel really at home very quickly. And yeah, very, very quickly, you know, found my new place down there.
Well, that's good to hear, Nick, to be honest. And it's nice to hear that obviously you had those good experiences with the Hampshire boys basically from day one. Because they are a nice club. To be honest, you've been quite lucky We've had some really good guests on from both Middlesex and Hampshire, both very decent cricket clubs, to say the least, with some excellent people involved at all levels of the club. But in terms of your first impression of the Southern County, what did you make of Hampshire County Cricket Club?
I think first and foremost, the ground's quite inspiring. Obviously, I came from Lords, which was an amazing cricket ground. But, you know, being a Middlesex player, I probably never really had a home ground. And without going too much back to Middlesex, it's actually the, you know, turning up to the GS, you know, being able to leave your kit in the dressing room, having that hub of a space where you eat food, you have your coffee, you chill out with the guys, you can train when you want to. There's an indoor school, gym, everything you need there on site. I guess at Hampshire, just, you know, first and foremost, the guys were just a really good set of lads. And then when you looked around the changing room, you saw the likes of James Vince, Liam Dawson, Carl Abbott, Keith Barker, all these guys who, you know, are class players and that you're really excited to be a part of the side up with. So that was pretty inspiring. And then, yeah, I guess just everything is, everything there is done to a very high standard, whether it's the sports science, whether it's the gym, whether it's the food, whether it's the training, the analysis. It feels like an international setup in a county setup. And yeah, I guess that we're reaping rewards at the moment as a squad from it.
Well, you most certainly are. It has been an absolutely sensational start to the season indeed. But before we talk about 2022, you mentioned all those big names there. Keith Barker, first and foremost, shout out to Keith. Wonderful player, great man as well. He's had a great start to the summer. And then you mentioned the likes of James Vince, Liam Dawson, Carl Abbott as well, all these massive names. Who was the first player to actually talk to you and introduce themselves down at Hampshire?
Well, I had a meeting before I obviously signed anything with Hampshire with James Vince and Adie Birrell. And I don't know if you've come across Adie Birrell, but he is, a very, very lovely South African. He's almost a bit like a funny old grandpa at times, but he plays up to that, image a bit to us. No, he's a great man. And I think fundamentally, he's just a great man, manager, and a great guy. And I think that's the thing that everyone prides themselves on at Hampshire's, you know, being a good character and a good person first and foremost, and the skill and people's cricket skills are secondary to that. So definitely James Vince and Adie Birrell was along with Charles White were the first people I met. But yeah, everyone's a really good guy down here.
Yeah, they seem like it, to be honest. It does seem like a lovely club. And again, we've had numerous Hampshire players on, always given us a lot of their time, always had some fantastic stories to tell as well. So big ups Hampshire. I do quite like them as a club. Obviously don't want them to beat Warwickshire this season, but other than that game, obviously wishing the boys all the best of luck. They're a nice bunch of lads. And in terms of your time down at the Aegeus Bowl so far, Nick, what do you say has been the highlight? Has there been a real standout moment? I mean, I can think of one from this summer, for example, already. But is there one moment in particular which stands out to you above all others from your time on the South Coast so far?
I think from last season, the quarter final at Notts, I wasn't actually allowed to play in the end because of the various restrictions from the ECB about being part of another county, etc., and on loan. But I remember carrying drinks that game, and I mean, yeah, you'll remember it. We bowled out for 110, and we had absolutely no hope. And then we came back and won that game at Trent Bridge. And I just remember thinking, this is a side I want to be a part of, you know. So although it was the T20 stuff, it was that was pretty special to me. And then I guess the whole championship run in last year was really special because it was something that I've been craving since 2016, I guess, and got the juices flowing. Sadly, didn't happen, but it showed me that this is where I wanted to be. So. I guess that's probably been the standout moment so far. It's been kind of competing for trophies.
Well, the county most certainly have. And you mentioned last year, the T20 Blast reaching the semi-finals and then the county championship. We cannot just let that slide, to be honest, because that final round was absolutely insane, wasn't it, to be honest? It was essentially a three-horse race at that point between Lancashire, Hampshire, and the eventual champions, my county of Warwickshire. In terms of that final game up at Egbeth, Nick, if you could put that into words and just try and describe that game and everything which went on, how on earth would you go about doing so?
I wish I could go back now and try and play like I'm playing now, because I feel like my game's in a better place than it was then. I guess just one of regret, really, because you're constantly looking back and thinking, you know, could I have just got another 20 runs and then, you know, everyone else could have done what they did and we could have won that game. But yeah, I guess just one of regret. But it's a good regret. It's good energy. It fuels you to go on. It's fueled the county to go on, you know, and sign Ben Brown this winter. And it's given everyone that kind of buzz to go again. You know, I think it's part of sport. It's painful, but you've got to get on with it. It's, you know, everyone feels it. Man City would have felt it the other day against Real Madrid on a completely different scale. It's just part of sport. There's a winner and a loser. And sadly, we lost that week when we probably should have won. But then in another year, we'll probably win when we should have lost. So it's part of sport. It hurts, but it's also what drives you on, I guess.
That's a very, very good way of looking at it, to be honest. Because again, if you do go on to lift that trophy, you'll look back on 2021 almost as a catalyst, almost of that moment that this is when we could have done it. Let's put in the things in place. Let's go and actually do it. And when that moment does come, if it does come at some point, maybe this year, if not 2023, again, you'll look back on 2021 and go, yeah, might have lost then, but look at us now with a county championship trophy in our hands, just like Warwickshire had at the end of 2021, which made a lot of us here in the Midlands very, very proud indeed. But a fantastic end to what was yet another engrossing season, to say the least, in 2021. And let's be honest, 2022 so far, we're five rounds in. And again, it's just been absolutely remarkable, hasn't it, to be honest? We've already got a nice title race developing at the top of Division 1. Division 2 has been so competitive as well, with Derbyshire coming out of seemingly nowhere under Mickey Arthur, with Shan Massoud, Saranga Lakmal in fantastic form. In terms of this season, Nick, what are your aspirations with Hampshire? Heading into, you know, all three competitions, what would you like to achieve in a Hampshire shirt in 2022?
Yeah, I guess as a squad, we feel like we can win all three, I guess. You know, we've obviously always been very strong in white ball cricket, and they've won a lot of trophies. I say they because I haven't been a part of those trophies, but as a club, we've won a lot of trophies over the last few years in white ball cricket, and more important than that, competed, you know, consistently in finals and finals days, and, you know, some are going to go your way and some aren't. But I think now that there's a real emphasis of the club to win the county championship, and I think you've seen that with the recruitment, and I guess that, yeah, that's there's nothing more simpler than that, that the whole squad is here to win trophies, really, and it's quite inspiring.
It most certainly is, and a very, very exciting time down on the south coast indeed. Only time will tell, of course. No one knows how the rest of this season will pan out, but I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to it, to be honest. I think it's going to be absolutely fantastic. The summer of 2022 just has the makings of yet another memorable county summer. And Nick, before we go on to the concluding parts of today's podcast, which will surround the future, to be honest, we do, of course, have our Twitter questions for today. So we'll start first and foremost with a question from Harrison, who's been on the podcast before, so big up to Harrison. He's a massive Hampshire fan. And he asks you, Nick, how did it feel to score those twin hundreds against Lancashire against an attack of that quality? How satisfying was that for you personally to not just lift the bat once, but twice in that same game?
Yeah, it was a very satisfying week, because obviously the team were under pressure as well during that game. We obviously knew how big a game it was against a really strong Lancashire side and a strong attack. And we were obviously under the pump on day one. So that was very satisfying to dig in when the team needs you and score runs when the team needs you. I guess that's the most satisfying time to do it. And then again, we were under pressure in the second inning. So to go again was, as you know, as you say, very satisfying. It was dampened slightly by the weather on day four, because we felt that had we bowled on day four and had a whole day at them on that pitch, we would have created 10 chances and had a good chance of winning what would have been a really good game of four-day cricket. So that was a bit of a dampener. But yeah, from a personal point of view, very satisfying, as you say.
Well, it was fantastic. And again, you did get quite the mention, to be honest, here on the podcast. So well done for that, Nick. Fantastic performance, to say the least. We did enjoy it here on the Counter Cricket Podcast, very much so. Obviously, the weather, unfortunately, did play spoil sport in what was a fantastic game between two very, very high-quality sides. But again, you can't control the weather. It's just one of those, isn't it? Especially in this country, as we all know, with the British weather. It's raining today, for goodness sake. So you just have to take it, unfortunately, as part and parcel of the British cricketing experience. And our next question, Nick, this is from Satvik. Satvik is a massive Counter Cricket fan from India. He supports Worcestershire. And Nick, he asks you, how difficult was it for you to shift from Middlesex, first and foremost? And where do you attribute your success up until now at Hampshire? That's quite an interesting question.
Yeah, well, obviously it was an extremely tough time to leave Middlesex because it was all I'd never known. So definitely, took a leap of faith, really, a leap into the unknown, certainly outside of my comfort zone. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was leaving my comfort zone. And what do I attribute my success so far at Hampshire to? I guess just the changing room, the, you know, relaxed nature of the changing room. And I think being part of a winning team really helps, because as you know, in cricket is, it's a tough game where you fail a lot and you fail more than you succeed. So when you fail, if others do well and the team does well, you can celebrate their success and it almost keeps you going. Whereas if you fail and then the team's losing as well, then it just becomes, the change room can become quite a tough place. But, you know, I've been fortunate that there are some high quality players around me, so that when I've failed for Hampshire so far, then they've had days out, which has been really nice to celebrate.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Nick, because, again, that is a big chunk of what we discuss here at the podcast, the psychological aspect of the game of cricket. So I know I haven't quite gone into it in as much detail in today's podcast, but in terms of those failures, how do you personally maintain that even keel with your cricket? Because, as you rightfully said, cricket at times is an incredibly tough and incredibly lonely place, in particular as a top or middle order batter, because you do fail an awful lot more times than you succeed. Yes, people remember the centuries, but they don't remember the 0, 1, 5, 10 that you might have got in the games previous. How do you maintain that level-headedness when things maybe haven't gone your way in the game per se?
I guess with experience, you learn that it's part of the game, first and foremost, as you get older. And I think having a set routine and processes that you go to, that you almost plug into every game, helps you to come to terms with failure, because if you've done your processes, if you've done your training and it hasn't worked that game, that's fine, because you've got a bank of experience behind you, knowing that if you keep doing that, then luck will turn and you'll get some runs and perform for the team. So I guess just having that bank of experience with processes tends to help.
Very interesting to know, to be honest. And some good advice as well. You can't beat experience in life, can you? Obviously learning those lessons, because unfortunately in the game of cricket, you do have to go through them. But once you've been through them, as you mentioned, put in the right processes, have those coping mechanisms, and you can get your game back on track in no time whatsoever. And in terms of our final question from the Twitter segments, Nick, to completely change the the mood and the seriousness of the questions today. This is from Mark Gooch. Now, I'm not quite sure where this question originates from, Mark. Please do let us know. But, Nick, what's your favourite flavour of crisps? I reckon he's a smoky bacon fan.
No, sadly not a smoky bacon man. I'm a salt and vinegar. Anything salt and vinegar is me. So kettle chips, the blue bag of balsamic vinegar and salt kettle chips, do go down well on any day of the year, but particularly when it's hot and sunny.
May I just say, that's a great shout. They are absolutely elite crisps, aren't they?
They're top shelf crisps.
Kettle and Tyrrell's, absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I can definitely agree with that, to be honest, Nick. And yeah, just an interesting question, to be honest, Mark. As I said, do let us know where the inspiration for that question came from. But yeah, that's just a nice way to wrap up the Twitter questions, to be honest, Nick. And going on to our final questions for today, it wouldn't be a TCCP interview without our teammate segment. So for those who don't know how this works, basically, in front of me, I've got an assortment of questions for Nick Gubbins to answer surrounding the teammates that he shares a dressing room with at the Aegeus Bowl. So Nick Gubbins, are you ready for TCCP teammates?
Yes.
Fantastic. That's what we like to hear. So Nick, first question, always a classic here on the podcast. Who is the teacher's pet down at Hampshire who is always hanging around the coaches?
The teacher's pet. That's a real tough first question. I'm gonna abstain from answering that for now, because there's no one that really hangs around with the coach. I'm struggling to. You obviously got the South African bond between Carl Abbott and Adi Birrell, but I wouldn't say that's a teacher's pet. I think that's more of a love hate son and father relationship.
It's funny you mentioned that. We've heard that so many times here on the podcast. I think, is Brad Wheel also part of that as well? He has got the South African connection.
Yeah, we've got a few South Africans. We've got Brad Wheel as well. There's a lot of accents flying around our changing room, which is good fun.
Most certainly is. Have they invited you for a bra yet, or has that not happened?
We've got a few bras lined up in the summer, probably when the weather turns, because at the moment it's very much an English barbecue. In the cold and wet, so yeah, eventually where the sun will come out and we'll have a braai.
Lucky for some. For those who don't know what a braai is, Google it. Honestly, they look absolutely fantastic. Always nice if you have got some South African friends, invite them over. And yeah, you do not cook them on gas though. That is something I've been told by many South African. It has to be wood or charcoal. But Nick, moving on to our next question then for today's segments. Again, it doesn't get any easier from here, to be honest. Who are the best and worst dressed down at the Aegeus Bowl?
Worst dressed. Who is the worst dressed? Ian Holland wears some pretty... He's an Australian, so he wears some dodgy gears, as most Australians do. In terms of best dressed, I mean, he just puts in a lot of effort, but Joe Wedley... puts in a lot of effort. His hair is always on point, and he tries to make sure that he's best dressed. But I don't agree with some of his gears. I'd say Ian Holland's definitely our resident Australian who dresses like an Australian.
It's funny you mention that. We've had both those guys here on the podcast. Joe looked absolutely $1 million. To be honest, he put us to shame in terms of the way in which he dressed and the hair as well, as you said.
Yeah.
Always seems to be perfect. He seems like he's got like a GQ magazine shoot in his house every single time. And then Ian Holland, in fairness, I didn't think Ian dressed that badly for the podcast. And I think he mentioned the name Kyle Abbott for that. Would you maybe put his name in the hat?
Abbo, he's probably wears a few granddad clothes as Abbo, from memory. But no, joking aside, I mean, nothing Kyle Abbott's worn has alerted me to worry about his dress sense. I think Ian's just diverting attention away from him now.
There we go. We've finally got the truth then. It's Ian Holland and not Carl Abbott, who's the worst dressed in the Hampshire dressing room. And moving on to our next one. Nick, this is finally a cricket-related question. Goodness me, wasn't expecting one of these on today's podcast. But who's the most likely to get timed out in that Hampshire dressing room? Who's really slow in the batting gear?
Felix Organ. Felix walked out to bat the other day at the Oval without his bat.
How?
He got halfway down the stairs at the Oval, turned back and realised he didn't have his bat in his hand. He is Felix is one of the great guys in the dressing room. He's a very, very funny, relaxed character, and I think he was almost too relaxed that day. So
we have not heard that on the podcast. We've heard things like forgetting a box. I remember Stuart Meeker telling us that. We've had forgetting thigh pads and arm guards. How on earth do you forget your bat?
we were asking the same thing. It was quite a crucial part of the match. We'd followed on at this point, and so, you know, tensions were quite high in the dressing room, and he started walking out to bat. We were like, what's he doing? And then he walked back up the stairs and he was like, I forgot my bat. And I have to say, it really did lighten the mood of what was quite a tense dressing room at that point. Everyone just burst out laughing, which is the exact response you need. And it's the exact sort of thing you need when mayhem's going on around you. Felix Auger will provide some humour.
Fair enough. I mean, as you said, yeah, you can see the the human. I just can't get over that. How the heck do you forget your bat? How? You're going out to bat. It says it in the name. I mean, what do you think everyone's got that big piece of willow in the hands for? Oh, well. To be fair to Felix, he did do well the other day, didn't he? Scoring his second career first-class ton.
No, it was that was one of the more enjoyable hundreds for everyone in the squad. He's, you know, everyone loves him. He's a great, great guy to have in the squad. We call him the James Milner of Hampshire because he bats wherever the team needs him to bat. You know, sometimes he bats seven. We needed him to bat four early in the year. He needed to open last innings because Joe Wedley did his hands. And so, yeah, he's almost James Milner. Wherever the team needs him to go, he'll go. And he's a great guy to have around.
Certainly sounds like it. And when you mention the nickname, I'm going to be honest. So I understand the logic now. I thought you were going to say because he's boring like James Milner. But no, nah. Luckily for Felix,
he's not boring, sadly.
The flexibility. Felix, if you're listening to today's podcast, get yourself on. The invite is always here from us at County Cricket.
It would be a very humorous podcast with him on. He's a funny guy.
There we go. Felix, make it happen. We shall be in touch either via Instagram or indeed on Twitter. But Nick, going on to our next one. This is interesting, actually. It's one of our newer questions here on the podcast. Who's got the strangest pre-game ritual? Has anybody in Hampshire got something quite unorthodox or outside of the box, which they do before going out to bat? I mean, Felix there forgetting his bat. Hopefully that doesn't become a ritual, but does anybody have anything quite strange that they do before a game?
Not that I can think of, no. I mean, yeah, sometimes guys will have a juggle in the change room if they're waiting to bat and they've had their pads on for a while, but yeah, I wouldn't say there's no Neil McKenzie that tapes his bat to a toilet ceiling, fortunately. There's a lot of darts that gets played in our change room, so we've got a darts board, and whenever we're batting, there's a lot of guys always playing darts and stuff, and it's a nice way to relax with a bit of music on. Keeps it pretty chilled.
I was going to say, that sounds like quite a nice dressing room, to be honest.
It's much more, yeah, I mean, having been in several dressing rooms, obviously, I think that's the generally the best way to go is to keep it pretty fun and keep it pretty lighthearted and chilled and almost do anything else other than cricket in the dressing room.
Sounds very nice. Makes me a little bit envious, to be honest. Sounds like quite a nice environment to play your cricket in. And you mentioned there about music. Nick, you could not have set me up any better for our next question, to be honest. Who is the dressing room DJ?
You're looking at the GS Bowl. You're staring right at the DJ. Yeah.
Case DJ Gubbo.
Yeah, DJ Gubsep, however you want to take it. I'm in charge of the speaker at the moment, and I haven't had too many complaints, which is always quite rewarding.
What are the choice of tunes, if you don't mind me asking, Nick?
Depending on the mood, you've got to look at what the audience needs. Before we go out and field, they're usually quite bubbly and pumped up. Whereas when we're batting, it's more relaxed. Me and Felix have been listening. We've done a lot of James Blunt recently. We've gone through the Back to Bedlam album, and a lot of Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jack Johnson. But yeah, very kind of relaxed tunes before we bat and before we field. We rev up the boys a bit.
I must say, I love the choice of Red Hot Chili Peppers. In particular, Can't Stop is an absolute tune. I remember Vladimir Klitschko used to do his ring walk to that in the world of boxing. But if you could give us one music recommendation then, Nick, you can go pretty mainstream or you can go quite niche.
Totally Tropical House on Spotify is pretty good vibes.
So, okay.
Totally Tropical House is my go-to.
I shall have a look at that after the podcast. I'll check it out. I'll give it a rating on Twitter if you want, Nick. We'll see what the choice of tune are like. And moving on to our penultimate question for today. Quite an apt question, actually, considering the facilities nearby the Aegeus Bowl, because you've essentially got an on-field golf course. You're quite lucky, to be honest, down in Southampton. Who's the best golfer
The best golfer is sadly Joe Weatherly. he's a pretty good sportsman. He's the best tennis player, the best golfer. So there's a few guys who are, you know, who are steady away and are good players, but Joe sadly takes it, takes the mantle there.
And on the flip side of that, who's the worst? Who can't play golf to save their life?
There's a few. I mean, I'm trying to think who doesn't play golf. I've never seen Keith Barker on a golf course. I think Keith, when he's not bowling, doesn't like to walk around a golf course. I think he likes to just chill. I can't imagine Keith just going and looking for his ball in the rough. I imagine he'd have a pretty short fuse on the course. So I might try and get him out there at some point. But yeah, I don't think Keith wants to have a walk around. he'd probably try and sweep or reverse sweep.
Nick, please make that happen. I'd love to see Keith on a golf course.
Yeah, I think he'll take quite some persuading to do that.
I'll tell you what, though. I think he'd be quite good at driving. I think he'd have a good drive on him because he's a powerful man.
Oh, is he?
Goodness me, we'll have to wait and see. Who knows? Keith Barker could become most improved golfer down in Hampshire. We'll have to wait and see, Nick. You'll have to convince him in the next few weeks or so when the weather gets a bit better. But Nick, moving on to our final question of today's podcast. We always ask it here on the podcast because it is approaching summer now. I've got to be honest, I don't know when this program is actually on in 2022. I don't usually watch it. I still don't know why we ask it on the podcast, but who's the most likely to appear on Love Island in the Hampshire dressing room? Who would you back to do well on that show?
Who would I back to do well? Wow, now that's a good question. I'm trying to run through. I mean, we've got a fairly mature dressing room. I'd say there's a few of the older guys. I can't see them on Love Island. I'd like to see James Vince on Love Island, but he's obviously got two kids and is married, so I'm probably gonna have to go for one of the younger guys who Joe Weatherly is a single man at the moment, so I think he would be, you know, on that walk out when you walk out with your, you know, hair all done up. I think he'd enjoy that, and he'd give it a good strut, that's for sure. But yeah, a few of the younger guys as well there. But yeah, not really sure, to be honest.
Good thing about Joe Weatherly as well, they wouldn't need all the hair and makeup teams because he does it all himself.
Exactly, yeah.
Just naturally perfect. So Joe Weatherly on Love Island. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. Joe, if you're listening, get your representatives in touch with ITV. Fingers crossed, win it for us. Win it on behalf of County Cricket and the County Cricket podcast. Do us all proud, mate. Obviously, no, of course, we are joking. We need Joe to be playing cricket, not going on Love Island. That's the last thing we need, to be honest, in particular with the T20s around the corner. But Nick, I think that is a fantastic place to wrap up what's been a thoroughly, thoroughly entertaining episode of the County Cricket podcast. The last hour's basically just flown by, to be honest, on my end. So before we say our final goodbyes for the recording, do you have anything to plug or promote? Any social media channels, websites, anything like that?
No, absolutely. That's great. Thank you very much for having me on, guys. And yeah, I hope you enjoy listening and haven't fallen asleep yet.
No, I'm sure they won't have, Nick. It's been absolutely fantastic getting you on. And to be honest, mate, you're always welcome back here on the County Cricket podcast, heading into the rest of the future and, of course, beyond. And just one final thing as well, which I didn't mention at the end of the team, mate. Obviously, wishing yourself and the Hampshire boys all the best of luck heading into the rest of the summer of 2022. Has got the makings of a very, very interesting summer. Again, we'll be here to cover each and every single competition throughout the entire summer. And yeah, just can't wait. And fingers crossed, Nick, more centuries, maybe a trophy. We shall have to wait and see. But that is it from us two here at the County Cricket Podcast for today's episode. To all of you wonderful listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.